case for the day today is J.D. Irving Limited v. United States, docket number 23-1652.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You can proceed when you're ready, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you. May it please the Court. The Court of the National Trade has jurisdiction under 1581I to hear J.D. Irving's appeal of Commerce's cash deposit rate instructions. The well-established test for 1581I jurisdiction is twofold. Number one, it is whether another subsection of 1581 is available or could have been available. And number two, if so, whether relief under that other subsection of 1581 would be manifestly inadequate. Here, although only one of the two criteria is required to be met, we satisfy both. Number one, no other subsection of 1581 is available.
Why isn't Section 1581C available, particularly given, for example, the concession in your complaint that that's ordinarily the section that would be cited or under which jurisdiction in the Court of International Trade would lie?
Correct. 1581C is unavailable for two reasons. Number one, the final results of the 2019 review were taken to a USMCA binational panel, but more importantly...
But that doesn't mean that it can't be used. That's what would normally be used. But you can't go to the binational... I mean, you could go to the binational panel with this issue. The problem is that just because there was a case for the binational panel doesn't mean that jurisdiction wouldn't normally lie under 1581C.
Well, I direct you, Your Honor, to this Court's decisions in Consolidated Barons and American Signature, where even though a plaintiff importer did not participate in the review but could have, the Court still permitted jurisdiction under 1581I for the importer to challenge Commerce's liquidation instructions to
Customs. But liquidation instructions are different, aren't they?
They're very much analogous to cash deposit rate instructions because in both instances, Department of Commerce is instructing U.S. Customs what to do, whether it's an assessment rate by virtue of liquidation instructions or a cash deposit rate by virtue of cash deposit rate instructions. And in Consolidated Barons and American Signature, this Court recognized that although the plaintiff could have participated in the underlying administrative review, nevertheless, the true nature of the plaintiff's appeal was a challenge to Commerce's cash deposit, liquidation instructions,
which differed from the rate, right?
Right, which are not a reviewable determination. And in this case, despite the fact that what we raised the issue before Commerce, we tried to exhaust our administrative remedies. Despite that, the true nature of our appeal remains a challenge to Commerce's cash deposit rate instructions.
I'm having a hard time understanding. I think there's just some fundamental thing I'm missing with your argument. I'm just not understanding, which is that, you know, you asked Commerce to consider this very argument about the instructions. They did. And they said, no, you're wrong. Here's our reasons for why you're wrong. And then you tried to file a case before the CIT, right? Or said you were going to file a case. And what I'm having a problem understanding is why doesn't just that determination by Commerce fall under 1581C?
It could. It ordinarily could. We could have, if there were no...
Well, isn't that sufficient, though, under this statutory framework? If it could, then you look to Section C of 1581, correct?
True, but again, I direct your honors again to this court's decisions in Consolidated Bearings and American Signature.
But those cases were cases where those issues could not have been brought under 1581C. That's the fundamental difference.
Respectfully, I disagree. That's not true. In fact, our facts are stronger than the facts presented in Consolidated Bearings and American Signature, because in each of those cases, the plaintiff importer could have participated in the Commerce Administrative Review and raised the issue. But never the, so
but
that
you
means
did participate and you did raise the issue. That's
true, but it can't possibly be the case that we're in a worse position than a litigant when we try to exhaust our remedies.
I'm just following the statute. This is the way it's set up, right? I mean, our job. I'm not going to look at, oh, that doesn't make sense policy-wise. That's not our job here. Our job is to look at the statute. Here, you participated in the review. You raised the issue. Now we want to say some other part of the Court of International Trade's jurisdiction applies. That doesn't make any sense to me, to be honest.
Well, again, Your Honors, I would direct you to the Federal Circuit's decisions in Consolidated Bearings and American Signature, where even though the plaintiff could have participated in the review, such that jurisdiction
but
could have been...
I'm sorry. Let me just go to American Signature. In that, it says, as a result, for entries between the date of the preliminary determination and the amended preliminary determination, and for entries between the date of the final determination and the amended final determination, duties were assessed at the cash deposit rates erroneously calculated by Commerce. In short, although Commerce admitted errors in its calculated dumping margins, it did not correct for the overpayment of each cash deposit when it issued liquidation instructions. So is there some sort of inconsistency there, internal inconsistency, which would provide a distinction between the liquidation instructions and the issue that we're dealing with here?
Well, there's no inconsistency because the entries were liquidated by virtue of automatic liquidation instructions, which is the way it should normally work.
Well, this says there was an erroneous calculation. And in our situation, we have a rate, and then we have simple instructions that follow through with no variation between them. Is that correct?
What we have in our situation is very different because we're challenging a general commerce policy that's unlawful, by virtue of which Commerce prioritizes outdated cash deposit rates calculated, determined in the most recently completed administrative review over more recent cash deposit rates determined for a more recent period by
really,
operation of law.
Is that really your argument, though? I have your notice of intent to commence judicial review, and it indicates on paragraph 5, certain softwood lumber products from Canada, final results of anti-dumping duty administrative review 2019. So it's regarding the final results of the anti-dumping administrative review. It's not talking about this whole administrative scheme or enforcement. It's referring to the rates, final results.
But Your Honor, that's the argument I just described is the very argument we made before Commerce in our case brief. And in American Signature, the court recognized that even though the Commerce rejected the very argument the plaintiff wished to raise by virtue of under 1581I jurisdiction, that nevertheless the true nature of plaintiff's challenge were to liquidation instructions. Just like in our case, the true nature of our appeal is the cash deposit rate instructions and the unlawful.
How is that actually the true nature? And I believe we should be looking at the true nature, but how is that the true nature?
Because what Commerce does in an administrative review is it calculates a dumping rate for that review period, in this case, 2019. And then what Commerce does is that sets an assessment rate, the final 80 rate that applies to imports entered during 2019, and it calculates a new cash deposit rate. In this case, the 2019 review, it calculated a rate of 11.59%. We do not challenge that rate. We do not challenge the calculation of that rate or anything about it. Our argument is independent.
How is it independent if, for example, the notice of intent specifically refers to the final results of the review?
Right. We raised the issue in the final results of the review because we were attempting to exhaust our remedies and notify Commerce that they might, we were trying to prevent them from doing something unlawful. But our argument is distinct from the 2019 review in that it depends on an earlier action by Commerce whereby it already assigned J.D. Irving a deposit rate for a more recent period, 2020, by operation of law. That's totally separate from 2019.
If the rate had not increased, would you be bringing this challenge?
We would have had the right to bring it. Of course, probably not, but we have the right to bring it because it's what Commerce did was unlawful. It would have been unlawful either way, but in our circumstance, obviously we're bringing the case because we're looking for the best result for the company.
And do you get notice of the rate change before the rate is actually changed?
No, we did not. That's part of the problem. That really goes to the merits and why we're contesting this unlawful commerce policy. Because under...
Isn't there a preliminary notice that goes out?
The preliminary notice in the 2019 review actually took place after review requests were due for the 2020 period. So we had no idea what the 2019 rate would be. What we did know is that the rate in that existed was 1.57%, and both neither we nor the petitioner nor any other party requested a review of J.D. Irving for 2020, and that means that under congressional intent, there's agreement that 1.57%, and this is by operation of law, is J.D. Irving's dumping rate for 2020. And our argument is that, which we'd like our day in court to prove, is that both under the statute and consistent with congressional intent, Commerce's policy whereby, or practice whereby it neglected the fact that Irving already had a dumping determination for 2020 by operation of law and replaced that 2020 rate with an outdated 2019 rate.
Right, but there is a full statutory structure in terms of how to challenge these various rates. So, you know, on the one-year anniversary of the, I believe it's the duty instruction at the start, you can then file your necessary paperwork. And I recognize that you were satisfied with your initial rate of
7%, right.
Okay. So you didn't do anything the following year. But you recognize that is the structure. And those in this business recognize that that is the structure. So you do have an opportunity to put something in terms of paperwork on that issue, regardless of what you know might be happening, because you recognize these rates can change, no?
But that's the unlawful, that goes to the unlawful practice that we'd like to challenge on the merits. And what you're referring to is the normal administrative review process. But that process, and this goes to the second prong of the 15A1I test.
Why aren't you able to raise that issue before the binational panel? If the binational panel has jurisdiction to consider whether determinations of commerce are inconsistent with statutes or regulations.
Binational panel is authorized under Section 1516AG to review reviewable determinations, such as the final results of the 2019 review, but it does not have authority to review cash deposit instructions, which we've appealed. And on top of that,
what source of law do you have for that? I mean, because I looked at, for example, I'm looking at the agreement between, you know, the U.S.-Canada-Mexico agreement, and it reads to me as if the binational panel is going to, it says the United States has to amend its statutes and regulations to ensure concerning many different things, including interest and on anti-dumping duties, and I'm not looking at the right section, but what law do you have for saying that they're not entitled to review this issue? Is there a case law? Is there anything?
No, Your Honor. If I may clarify, Your Honor.
Yes.
A USMCA panel can review the issue. A USMCA panel, however, is powerless to provide any relief. So So,
well, they're able to do a remand, aren't they?
But a remand would achieve nothing. And let me
can't they do a directive in a remand that Commerce is required to follow?
No. What we need is injunctive relief.
I do believe there is reference in the statutory structure that Commerce is required to follow whatever directive they receive. How would that not be appropriate here?
Under the law, under the statute, 28 U.S.C. 1585 and 28 U.S.C. 2643C, the Court of National Trade, Congress vested the Court of National Trade with injunctive powers like any Article III district court. There are no analogous provisions under the law that provide that relief to the USMCA panel.
Why do you need injunctive relief when the other may be appropriate? I mean, certainly that is how the structure is. Commerce would be required then to look to see what was provided in the order and adhere to it. What if they change the rate?
USMCA panels can only require direct Commerce to change rates prospectively, not retroactively.
Can they provide for a refund?
No, Your Honor, no. They lack those injunctive powers. There's no
way. They provide remand instructions?
USMCA panel has no authority under the law to enjoin Commerce to instruct Customs to retroactively reinstate the lawful AD cash deposit rate and refund J.D. Irving the overpaid AD cash deposits.
You are out of your rebuttal time even, so why don't we hear from the government for a little bit, and I'll give you 3 minutes.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Okay.
Mr. Lau, maybe?
Good morning. And may it please the court, this case is about a Canadian company's efforts to avoid the binational panel that has been requested to review the final results that J.D. Irving contests here. So the decision below should be affirmed because the CIT properly found that it lacks jurisdiction given the pending request for binational panel review. And there are 4 points I would like to address. First, Congress foreclosed CIT jurisdiction over the determination at issue in this case, the final results, because the final results are subject to a binational panel review. Now, without such a ruling, if this case could theoretically proceed while a binational panel is going on, you have the possibility of inconsistent results. You could have different cash deposit rates applied to different companies that are similarly situated. And that's why Congress directed that all challenges to the final results are channeled to the same forum. Second, there are statutory exceptions to the request for binational panel review that do not apply here. Congress set forth 6 specific exceptions and two exceptions for constitutional issues. None of those apply. Plaintiff has not argued that any of those apply. And there's no implicit exception if the plaintiff doesn't like the remedy that the binational panel is prepared to provide. Third, J.D. Irving can circumvent the binational panel by alleging that it really challenges the cash deposit instructions rather than the final results, because it challenges the final results, and 1581C jurisdiction would have been available but for the request for binational panel review.
Do you think that 1581C also covers their challenge to the instructions?
Well, in this case it does, because the instructions are entirely consistent with Commerce's findings with respect to the arguments about the cash deposit instructions.
Is that also supported with Commerce actually addressed this very issue?
Yes, I could show you in the...
It's okay. We saw it, yeah.
In the appendix, it did, in the issues and decision memorandum. The final result specifically says that the rates here will be used to determine cash deposit rates. So,
but you think that outcome could be different had they not addressed the decision below?
Which
I don't know that it matters, but if Commerce hadn't, if it hadn't been, this very issue hadn't been raised to them during the second administrative review, and then they actually addressed it, could you end up with a different result? That is, that the issue would not be raised under 1581C?
I can't say all the time, but as a general rule, like, no, it would be an argument that the, because cash deposit rates are determined based on the results of administrative reviews, if you're going to argue that the cash deposit rates were, there's nothing about the administrative review that's different than what the party could have raised, had it argued here. But it's not like, in the cases that the plaintiff is citing, like Consolidated Bearings, and,
American Signature.
An American Signature, right. Those were cases where the parties didn't participate in the review, didn't raise these arguments, and there were independent errors that weren't necessarily apparent from just the existence of the review.
But here, his response is, well, that's not fair because they, just because they didn't participate, they get some added benefit of being able to raise the issue before the CIT?
I'm not sure if they could have necessarily raised that issue and could have predicted the error that was ultimately, that ultimately occurred that they're seeking to challenge. But to be honest, it's a risk that, you know, a party could take not to challenge it and see what happens. I mean, the problem with those
cases, I want to follow up on one of her questions. I know you have a fourth point, and I was waiting for it with bated breath, but I don't, and I'm running out of time, so I'm going to have to just go. So she had a question, Judge Stoll did, about retroactive relief being able to be given to by the binational panel. Can you answer what you think in terms of when that retroactive relief can be given?
Well, I understand the question, because to mean is retroactive relief means that to the extent that entries have already been liquidated, the panel can't necessarily order the reliquidation of those entries. And I will ask my colleague from the Department of Commerce to correct me if that's wrong. But to the extent that, but the entries here, the liquidation has been suspended. So there wouldn't need to be any sort of reliquidation of previously liquidated entries.
And so, so they could say that, what would the outcome be here? What sort of relief could the binational panel fashion?
Well, the binational panel can remand and can identify any error of fact in law. It applies the same standard of review that the CIT would apply. So whatever relief that's necessary to address an alleged error in the final results can be provided by the binational panel. We don't have any examples, for instance, of a case in which some sort of relief that was provided by a binational panel was insufficient. And
I mean,
didn't address the error.
He seemed to be concerned, he being your opposing counsel, about that he needed injunctive relief and that was something that they could not do. Can you respond directly to that point?
Well, there are two issues. One, first of all, the general remedy under 1516A in an anti-dumping case would be a remand, whether it's the Court of International Trade, whether it's the binational panel, that's what you generally get, a remand. The difference is, the only injunctive relief that's actually provided with respect to under 1516A refers to the enjoining the liquidation of entries. But there's also a parallel provision that directs Commerce to suspend liquidation when there's a request for a binational panel review, if requested. It's actually an easier standard to meet than the CIT standard. But so in that respect, the remedies are parallel. To the extent that there's an argument, well, an Article III court, such as the Court of International Trade, has these inherent powers that it could draw upon to enjoin what we believe is an error that requires injunctive relief. You know, I don't know why the binational panel couldn't issue a remand order that addresses the same remedy. Commerce would be required to take action not inconsistent with that order, and you know, and whatever relief that the plaintiff requires would be provided.
So do I understand correctly that this case really is about the view that Commerce took too much in its deposit rate? And let me try it this way. For the review period 2020, if ultimately a determination was made that the appropriate rate was 1.5% for the review year 2020, that is the rate that would apply when these entries are liquidated, right?
Because, well,
even though the cash deposit rate was based on a higher amount from 2019.
Well, in 2020, they actually didn't seek review.
Okay.
So the entries, the cash deposits that they paid, which were something like 6% for the first 11 months and then 1.57%, are the liquidation rates, are the duties that are assessed. So for that year, J.D. Irving elected not to challenge the final results for AR3, although it did participate in Commerce's review process. And they have also filed a parallel suit in the Court of International Trade to challenge those results. The final point we wanted to address was...
Point number four, right?
Point four, yes. Is that under the residual jurisdiction provision 1581I, as counsel mentioned, the standard is if another provision... Jurisdiction's only is not proper if another provision is or could have been available unless the remedies under that provision are manifestly inadequate. I think we addressed the general points that the remedies that are available to the plaintiff are not manifestly inadequate because it could provide, you know, substantively the same relief that they're seeking in the Court of International Trade.
You think regardless of whether he's calling it an injunction or if you're looking at all the various remedies that you just discussed, including remand and the specifics of that, that would be equivalent?
Yes.
And also, I think the case law does provide as well that it doesn't have to be the preferred form of remedy. It just
yes.
needs to be the appropriate remedy, correct?
That is correct.
You might have been ready to stop, but let me ask one more question. I know, and following up on Judge Stoll's question, I believe in the complaint itself, paragraph 5, that's when they speak to the fact that 1581C would have been available. I think I'm going to write paragraph. Obviously, she could correct me if I'm mistaken about the paragraph she was referring to in the complaint. But my next sort of follow-up on that was, in terms of looking at the true nature of the challenge, right? They're saying it's the instructions. I think you're really saying it's the results. Would we partially need to look at what's stated in the pleadings, such as the complaint, to figure out what is really the true nature here?
Yeah, and I mean, that's evidence that the court can consider as to when it evaluates whether this is actually a challenge to a determination to the final results or to the cash deposit instructions. I mean, there's no disconnect. The cash deposit instructions are an instruction from Commerce to Customs to execute what Commerce had already determined in the final results.
So you're saying there's no change between those two? There's no inconsistency such that we would be looking at the instructions versus the fee rate? You're saying we should just be looking at the fee rate?
That's you would look at the final results.
The final yes. results.
Which includes
the instructions.
Which
includes the instructions because that was an issue that was raised to Commerce.
That's correct.
Okay. Got it.
And just so I understand your position, if there was a difference between the final fee rate and the instruction and the numbers came out different, how would your analysis change?
So if the liquidation instruction said, you know, not the liquidation, sorry, the cash deposit instruction said collect 10%, but the final result said collect 5%?
Yes.
Well, that would be a different case. That's closer to what, you know, Consolidated Bearings looks like or even Cooper Tire.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't want to bind, you know, the United States
no,
to say
I understand,
in all
but
cases.
That's a different circumstance.
It's a different case, yes. I mean, there's no way you could grant the plaintiff the relief it seeks without changing the final results.
Mm-hmm. Very well.
And the court has no further questions. We respectfully request that it affirm the judgment below.
Thank you. Mr. Campbell, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you so much, Your Honors, and I really appreciate the additional time. What my colleague just said, that there's no way to give J.D. Irving what it wants unless the 2019 final results are changed is absolutely untrue, because our whole argument is that by operation of law, J.D. Irving already received a dumping rate and cash deposit rate for a more recent period, 2020. That's by operation of law. That was supposed to supersede any decision by Commerce in the 2019 review.
I think that he thinks that the second review determination results includes Commerce's determination on the instructions. I think that's how he's interpreting it. So if that's so, how would that change what you just said?
we recognize, of course, we raised this issue that the 2020 cash deposit rate should continue to apply, not the 2019 cash deposit rate, in the 2019 review, and Commerce addressed it. However, again, a NAFTA panel is unable to remedy that, and we did not appeal the 2019 final results to the CIT. We appealed Commerce's cash deposit instructions. And I want to get back to this manifest inadequacy point. While USMCA panels have remand authority is not injunctive power. And that's clear by looking at 28 U.S.C. section 2643C, which grants this Court of International Trade both remand authority and the power to issue injunctions. They're different things. And let me provide one example to try to crystallize what we're talking about here. And this is a hypothetical that the government did not address, that we raised in our initial briefing, the government did not address. This is what we're talking about. Let's take a scenario where in a review, it's the 2019 review, Commerce calculates, says JDI's dumping rate in 2019 was 5%. Okay, so that's our dumping rate. But then, completely unlawfully, arbitrarily, Commerce nevertheless instructs Customs to impose a 1,000% deposit rate. That is completely unlawful. That cannot be corrected by participation in administrative reviews, because Commerce's legal unlawful decision to impose a 1,000% deposit rate is unremitied. And the only way to remedy that legal error is to get an injunction, which the Court of International Trade did provide in Cooper Tire, showing that the Court of International Trade has this authority. The Court of International Trade issued an injunction instructing Commerce to reinstate the lawful cash deposit rate retroactively and refund the overpaid cash deposit.
Is there really, though, any distinction between a remand with instructions and just an injunction which instructs?
The distinction is that a USMCA panel does not have that authority in a remand to order Commerce to take such action. And for more evidence of this, I refer you to Stainless Steel Sheet and Strip, a NAFTA panel decision from 2011, which the government cited in their response brief. In that very brief, the plaintiff challenged an 80 deposit rate, but the NAFTA panel decided that, well, the issue was moot because the deposit rate was already superseded by a new cash deposit rate. So the panel recognized it didn't have any power to do exactly what we need to be done, an injunction issued to retroactively reinstate the lawful cash deposit rate. Thank you for your
time.
Thank
you. The case is submitted on the briefs. We thank counsel for the helpful argument on this case.